on this episode of Still Loading, the mightiest of mics. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, we are going to be exploring a game that's a personal favorite of mine, a game that not a lot of people talk about, at least not that in my circles. And my guest mentioned off mic that he has something to say about that, so I'm excited to hear. But as soon as I started planning this episode, then a bunch of people mentioned that they've heard of this game. And of course, we are talking about the Macintosh, technically no longer exclusive, but at the time it was released exclusive, the Macintosh exclusive game Power Pete, later known as Mighty Mike. And joining me today is the, if I remember your title correctly, the librarian of the librarian of the Video Game History Foundation, Phil Salvador. Phil, how are you doing today?
Hey there, thanks for having me. Doing all right, all things considered. Happy to be here. It's really funny. Like when you invited me to this podcast, I occasionally get, invitations to podcasts. And when you mentioned Power Pete, it was like, okay, that's weirdly specific enough that I really want to be on this episode. So
thank you so much for agreeing to come on. So we have a mutual friend, Dan Greenberg, who I asked him, I was like, do you know anyone who knows anything about Power Pete? Because Mac gaming is such, most people growing up in the 90s did a lot more PC gaming than Mac gaming. And Mac gaming was its own niche in and of itself. And me growing up, my parents actually bought a Macintosh. I'm sure I'm assuming it's one of the Performas. I actually don't even know which one it is. They still have it. It's in the basement in my parents' house. Like I think it might even still work if the high levels of moisture down there haven't completely ruined everything. Oof. But this game was one of my first games that I ever played, and for one of the earliest memories for me growing up as a kid. So when I started getting into the podcasting sphere and like video game content creation and retro gaming and all this other stuff, no one knew about this game. No one ever talked about this game. And so I was so happy when Dan mentioned that you are a big Mac gamer in general. So for my listeners, after that long preamble, tell everyone, first off, a little bit about yourself and B, some of your personal history with Mac gaming and Power Pete.
Yeah, of course. So like you said, my current job right now, I'm the library director at the Video Game History Foundation. So I'm helping with our archives of materials, helping catalog all the exciting things we've been collecting and working us towards getting our digital library available for research. And that's just going to be all sorts of exciting video game history material. But that's kind of not why I'm here, though. Prior to being at VGHF and still ongoing now, I have a blog called The Obscuratory, where I revisit older, unusual video games. And it's kind of the same thing that you mentioned, where it's, I had a lot of games growing up because I also had a Macintosh. I had a Performa, actually, as well. I had an old Windows computer, and I played a lot of these kind of unusual shareware CD-ROM games, and it was born out of kind of a confusion of, seeing some of the early like game blogs and content creator folks, kind of repeatedly mining the same terrain of like, let's talk about Mega Man and Contra and Final Fantasy, and thinking like, well, there's this whole weird other world of stuff, and a big part of it for me was Macintosh games. So that was, I think when I started, one of the things I really wanted to set out to do was to focus more on Mac games. And I think we are seeing, as emulation improves, as people start digging into some of the deeper corners of stuff, we're seeing more attention brought to this. I do have to mention, I don't have it immediately on hand, but I want to mention Richard Moss's book, The Secret History of Mac Gaming, which is a very, very thorough book about just all sorts of corners in Macintosh game development, because it was this kind of separate community happening parallel to what was going on with PC game development and all that. It was this kind of self-serving smaller audience that made these really unusual expressionistic games, because Macintoshes could do, high color graphics and sound before that was really as feasible on computers. So you ended up with you know, weird things like Power Pete coming along that were developed by small independent teams.
And Power Pete, what blew me away about it now, like looking back, are the visuals for this game. I mean, I don't really have much to compare it to, but it came out on August 8th, 1995, and it looks like an enhanced 16-bit game. Would you agree with that?
I think to draw a comparison tech-wise, because I assume folks listening to this podcast might be more familiar with what was happening in like the PC game space in 1995. Mm-hmm. That there weren't a lot of games that, you know, looked like, just like pulling a random example, like a PS1 like side-scrolling game or something like that. There wasn't a whole lot like that on PCs. Macintosh computers were, generally speaking, better at doing high color, kind of smooth moving, action oriented graphics, multimedia stuff. That was generally earlier on in the 90s, that was kind of their strong suit. So you saw a lot more independent developers making games that were, you know, high color graphics at 640 by 480 resolution, which was, you know, high resolution graphics for its time with digitized voices and sounds. You saw that happening earlier on the Mac. So I think this fits into what was happening in the Mac game scene at that time, where they were just able to get more out of the computers, despite them technically not being, you know, as much of the game computers as I think, you know, DOS and Windows were becoming associated with at that point.
Makes sense. The developer of this game, you were just mentioning how developers for Mac were able to get a lot of high color, artwork and a lot of power out of the systems, even though you weren't quite expecting it at the time. And it was developed, this game was developed by Pangea Software. It was originally called Power Pete, but that was actually forced on them by their publisher, MacPlay, and they hated it. They absolutely hated it. It's funny, so this is my second attempt to do an episode on this game. Now, the first episode did actually get released. It's actually, I want to say, episode 2 of the podcast, which you can't even listen to anymore because it's hidden on SoundCloud because of SoundCloud's garbage, like, data storage limits and stuff like that. I do plan on re-releasing it for the 10th anniversary of the show next year. I meant to do it this summer. Yeah, I don't know how good it is. I haven't listened to it in almost a decade, and it was also, once again, second episode, so I've learned a lot since then.
Oh, it's going back, it's going to be like all like staticky microphone, like apologizing for missing the last, like that's always what happens going back to like your second thing you publish. It's always going to sound like that.
Luckily my audio was never awful, but it was very much like you said, where you're always apologizing. I'm sorry I missed this date. I was going to release an episode last week. And that's how the first like 2 years of my show were.
But you said this was your second attempt at doing this, which implies something happened or it wasn't a complete, well, like
attempt isn't the right word. This is my second go at doing an episode on Power Pete. So the first, my first attempt / go did actually get released. So I wouldn't say it's an attempt.
Okay.
This is so the first time, and I mean no shade towards my co-host at the time, one of my best friends, Justin, but he didn't have a personal history with Power Pete and Mighty Make, nor did he have any really knowledge of Mac gaming general like you do, Phil. So this is, you know, like years later, I'm redoing some of my old episodes that I feel like I could do better on, and this really fits into that. And growing up, I played this a ton. My dad and I actually would play this, and he was the type that found it hilarious that you were this big, buff, manly dude rescuing fuzzy bunnies. That's the whole premise of this game, where you play as Power Pete, who is an action figure. I'm sorry, Mighty Mike. The reason, by the way, that they forced them to change it was because they were worried that the name Mighty Mike was too close to Mighty Mouse, and they didn't want to be sued.
And I do want to say for the record, I looked this up because I saw that in your notes, and I thought that sounds like apocryphal, like something someone would make up. And I checked, and there is a Reddit post that links to the no longer existing Pangea Software message forums where the game's creator said that directly. So that is
word of God
on that.
I can do you one better. I have email correspondence from him from when I did the episode 10 years ago.
Beautiful. Okay.
That's where I got most of this information from.
just as a historian, I'm always a stickler for making sure like sources are correct. So like, I just want to say like, yes, this is accurate for folks listening. This is actually what happened.
I appreciate that. And no, I appreciate that for on a number of levels. A, I do try to be historically accurate. B, what is it? I did a recently, it just kind of reminds me of this. I was at Retro World Expo and I did a panel on the history of James Bond in video games. And there was something, it was a minor, I shouldn't say minor, but it was something that I will need to correct. And thankfully I didn't record it. So it's not like I publish it and then end up being wrong.
But no one will know.
Exactly. Well, one of the staffers at Retro World pulled me aside very politely. That makes it sound like it was something like it was a problem. He was so nice and polite. His name was, oh shoot. He didn't even give me his last name. I think it was Ryan, but he, the Atari 2600 game for James Bond, the 007 game on there, I said it was a game that it very much screams that it was a game that wasn't meant to be a James Bond license, and they just slapped the Bond license on it. That's not actually historically, that's not true. He went into a very detailed explanation about how Parker Brothers owned the copyright or owned the license for a James Bond video game, and the first developer that they tried to hire, it basically went bankrupt, and so they couldn't finish the game, and so they brought in a bunch of like almost like personal friends and created a company from, I don't know if it was for this game specifically or they had created a company prior, and so Parker Brothers was like, here, do this in like 3 weeks or something like that. So it did intend to be a Bond game, but it was just done under an insane time crunch.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, and as a sidebar, like, that's kind of one thing we're concerned about, the Video Game History Foundation, is, like, so many things just kind of exist as trivia in the ether, and, like, you always have to bring it back to the original source and figure out, like, well, why is that information out there? So in this case, yes, Power Pete, Mighty Mouse, the whole thing, accurate is the point.
And another thing that he wrote to me in his email was Pangea hated the name change. Besides the name change, excuse me, they also hated the box art. None of the characters look like they do in the game, and he specifically cited there's a kangaroo on the box which never appears in the game at all. So I was kind of bummed when I reached out to him. I was hoping he'd like offer some more information, but I also he only gave like two or three fun facts, but I wanted to include them nonetheless. Pangea did get the rights back to the game in 2001, which is when they finally were able to rename it Mighty Mike. And one of the cooler aspects of this, which you can find now online completely for free, in 2021 they released the source code for not just this game but a bunch of their titles, and you can download this game. A fan of these games took the source code and ported it over to modern PCs, and not just this game, they also did Bugdom, Chromag Rally, Automatic, Nanosar 1 and 2, which I've never played any of these, mind you. I've only ever played Mighty Mike. Have you ever played any of these other Pangea Soft games?
I had an interaction with a couple of them, and this is actually, I want to jump a little bit ahead in the notes to talk about this because this is kind of a funny story. So I used to volunteer at the video game event out in Maryland that Daniel Greenberg, who you mentioned earlier, we would both go to it. And they had like kind of an old like classic computer room. They had this beautiful section with like all these old iMacs of all different colors. And the only games they had on them were Chromag Rally and Bugdom, which were two of the 3D games by Pangea Software. And I always wondered, like, what the hell? Are these the only games you have on any of these computers? And it's because they were bundled with some iMacs and with OS X. Like, they were able to get them bundled with Mac computers. And you mentioned in the notes, I didn't realize this, that Power Pete was also bundled with Mac OS 7 computers and Performa computers. And so what we said earlier about how, you know, you talked with a lot of folks who were like, oh yeah, I remember Power Pete. I think the only reason we're talking about it is because Pangea Software was good at getting their game out like that. I played it, it didn't come bundled with a computer. I just played it on a demo disc. And I think they were just effective. I mean, obviously they were going through, you know, Mac Play for some of this, but I think either them or MacPlay, or I guess combination of both, because, you know, Chromag and Bugdom were their own thing, they were just good at getting them out in different outlets. I think that was part of like the shareware distribution model. Like, you had to be able to hawk your game in different places and get it included on discs and make an easy pathway to getting the full game unlocked. And I think they were effective. Like, it obviously made an impression, and enough people played it that those folks, like, they're still around, right? So I think I think that's why folks remember it. I think it's the only reason we're talking about it today is because they were good at distribution back then.
Yeah, and speaking of it being pre-installed on, or packaged with these computers, that's how I played it. It was packaged with our Performa back in like the mid-90s. I mean, I ended up playing a bunch of other games. Like I remember, you know, Star Wars. I think we had X-Wing. We also had, oh my gosh, what is it? It's the freaking Rebel Assault 1 and 2. Those are stupid hard games, at least for me as a kid. But anyway, I don't want to go. I can go off on tangents, so I'm going to avoid that. To dive into the game, well, actually, before we dive into the game, do you have any personal memories of PowerPeat? Did we talk? I felt like we kind of talked about it kind of like around, we kind of skirted around it a little bit, but did you have any personal memories of it, or was it something that you kind of found later on as an adult?
It was one of those games I played back when I had a computer as a kid, just having a demo disc. I think I had just like a MacPlay demo disc that had a bunch of things, including PowerPeat, and I played through it enough to get far enough in that I couldn't get any further because I was like 5 or 6 years old. I wasn't good at video games. But yeah, another one, I think a lot of games in that era you just encountered through demo discs or shareware CDs, even if you didn't upgrade them to the full version. And so I assume PowerPeat had a lot of people who got similar impressions of it back in the day that way. I do want to say before we move on, since you mentioned there are the, you know, the free versions for modern platforms, if folks listening to this want to play PowerPeat, I would say go to those ones right away. For this podcast, I went back and, you know, fired up the original version of PowerPeat in an old Macintosh emulator. And that thing is really finicky, I want to say. Games back then were, you know, often dependent on computer speed in some ways that kind of mess with them, and it was very hard to get it threading the needle between running way too fast and running a little too slow. Even at the right speed, it was a little choppy. The modern versions run great. They're smooth. It's wonderful. I would say just go ahead and play those ones immediately. Normally, I'm a big proponent of, like, go back and experience it as it was at least once to get the context for how it was played. You're not missing anything. Just go for the version you can get on itch.io. Just go for it.
And the guy who does it, the last name is Giorgio. They're from France. I don't know. I was actually hoping to get them on the podcast, not for this specifically, but just in general, because the Brian Greenberg, who is the guy who was the head of Pangea Software, who worked on this game, I've seen on his like social medias that he has directly shouted out Giorgio, or I apologize if I'm mispronouncing their name. I have no frame of reference, but he shouted them out because it feels like once the source code was released, it seems like they worked directly with him to help them port these games over to modern system. I can't say that for certain. That is a speculation. That is not gospel or fact. But just from seeing some of the social media posts between Greenberg and Giorgio, I feel like there is not necessarily an official collaboration, but it seems like he was a lot more open with some of the technical stuff than maybe he would be with other people, type of thing.
I mean, if there's a fan who comes along and it's like, hey, I will port your game to modern systems for you for fun, I mean, yeah, you want to cheer that guy on. Absolutely. Like, yeah.
Right. And not only just PowerPeat, like I mentioned, Nanosaur, Billy Frontier. I have not tried any of these yet, but I do plan on really digging into this. And I wanted to reach out to Giorgio and see if I could speak to them. But the only way I could find to message them is through sending a $3 tip on Ko-fi or Ko-fi or whatever. Coffee, whatever. How's it pronounced?
I've never heard it pronounced out loud. I don't know.
Ko-fi, I know, right?
I've said Ko-fi internally, but I have no frame of reference for that at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I will go Ko-fi. We'll just say it. We'll say it declaratively.
Sure.
Yeah, so maybe I'll send a tip and just ask, like, hey, I would love to speak to you on a podcast. We'll see how that goes. anyway. The what is PowerPeat? You know, we've kind of talked about this game and a little bit of its development.
Big muscly guy going around rescuing rabbits, got kind of like a like a Persona 4 kanji energy going on.
And Power Pete also kind of, I mean, it came out, what year did Toy Story come out? 93?
I think Toy Story also came out in 95. So it's just, I thought of this too.
Like, something in the air.
Yeah, for reference for folks. So in this game, you are playing as an action figure named Power Pete, who's got a big Buzz Lightyear-esque chin, who's going around rescuing toys in a toy store. Happened to come out the same year as Toy Story. Seems to be a complete coincidence.
I mean, that would just be, that's way too coincidental. I feel like there's, I can't imagine there was much overlap between Pangea Software and Pixar, but you never know. At the same time, you never know. The overall premise of the game, we talked about Power Pete, this action figure rescuing bunnies, but the actual, I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's a couple paragraphs long, but in the instructions, the instruction booklet, it gives a little one-page summary of the story, and I'll read a snippet of it here. Toy Mart has closed for the evening. The clerks have long since turned off cash registers, and the midnight janitor has left. Suddenly, the store comes alive as dolls, action figures, and game pieces jump to their feet. Within moments, cities are formed in the bargain bin. Racetracks become islands of action surrounded by a sea of onlooking toy robots. In the clown department, what Toy Story is a clown department? We'll get into that in a second.
Yeah, no, the clown department, yeah.
You know, as you do. that when I was reading that, I'm like, clown department? The fuck kind of Toy Story has a clown? Oh, well, that's nightmare-inducing for kids.
Honestly, it's the kind of thing that I think you could just, like, say and just move past, and it doesn't occur to you until, like, 5 minutes later. It's like, yeah, they're in the Toy Store. They go to the clown area, and there's all the clowns. And but it's not until later, it's like, oh, wait, that's not a thing. That's not a concept on Earth. So we're rolling with it. Clown department.
Clown department, and thousands of insane clowns initiate a massive pie fight. Throughout all of the departments, life arises. Now, before I continue on with the next paragraph, and like I said, I won't read the whole thing. There's only one more paragraph I'm going to read. This first one posits that not only is there a clown department, Phil, but these clowns also know how to cook because they initiate a massive pie fight. And I can't imagine the pies that would have been packaged with these toys were real pies. So, well,
they're from the pie department, obviously.
Oh, that's there we go. How could I have been so dumb? There's a pie department, clearly.
Separate sub-departments for everything, which actually in the game is like slightly true, which we'll get into. But
I love this fictional world that they've set up in Toy Mart, the generic name of Toy Mart. The next paragraph here, suddenly there is a commotion in the doll department. One of the cages in the stuffed animal zoo has broken open. Hundreds of fuzzy bunnies, even though you only rescue like, what, there's five permission, 15 times five. So you're looking at less than 100. I don't feel like mathing that right now. 75. Is that right?
Let's just say like 100. Some levels have more. Yeah. Let's round up and say 100 bunnies total.
100 bunnies. But in this one, they say that hundreds, okay, fair enough. But hundreds of fuzzy bunnies hop out of their cage and scatter. The fuzzy bunnies, with their limited intellect, do not realize the danger they are in. The new metropolis of Toy Mart can be a very dangerous place for fuzzy bunnies to wander alone. And without help, they stand little chance of surviving until morning. And the peaceful inhabitants of the doll department cry out for the fuzzy bunnies to return, but to no avail. What will they do? What will become of the fuzzy bunnies? And then in comes Power Pete with the quote, I will help you. And I'm not going to read the rest of it, but or Mighty Mike. I just call him Power Pete because that's how I remember it as.
It has more punch. I don't know. Power Pete just sounds better than Mighty Mike. I know.
Thank you. I was worried that was just me, and I know they intended it to be Mighty Mike, but I kind of like Power Pete more.
And it has a little bit of parallel with like Power Macintosh computers. I don't know. It fits. I think it works better.
I agree. I definitely agree. And I love the premise of this and how melodramatic this shows in the game, because every time you start a level, you see, like, Pete, like, they have this really cool graphic, you know, some kind of, like, butt rock music playing in the background. And Power Pete's looking dramatic as he's walking into the next section of the toy store. But if you die or if you quit, they give you this equally dramatic exit screen of, you know, Power Pete falling over, his legs kind of falling apart. And it's basically makes you feel guilty for even putting the game down. It's pretty hardcore.
I mean, this is Pete's life. He's taking this very seriously. I mean, for us, it's obviously it's toys, but for him, like, it's like Buzz Lightyear. It's his entire world.
And those bunnies, man, they need to be saved. I mean, they're going to get mixed into that pie department, and who knows who's going to eat them by accident.
Yeah, I think it's really funny that there's an implication that certain toys in the toy store are just inherently evil and, like, will destroy you. Like, I think in Toy Story, like, the toys, to an extent, get along. Like, there's villains, like, there's Zurg or whatever, but, like, there's not, like, oh, don't go into that corner of, like, Andy's room. The toys will literally murder you. Like, the sheep and the dinosaur get along. They're all kind of on the same team, but this one, it's like, those bunnies are doomed. They went to, like, the dinosaur area. You will never see them again unless Power Pete saves them.
And, you know, in Toy Story, they at least give their evil toys the characteristics of, you know, like, the Stinky Prospector, Stinky Pete. The reason he's evil is because he's always been the shelf toy and never got to was never given a child's love, you know, never got to be played with as a toy is supposed to, type of thing. And so he's bitter about it. So now that he has his chance to actually feel some type of adoration, then he, you know, that's why he's evil. And they do the same thing in Toy Story 3 and so on and so forth.
Now, in this one, toys are born sociopathic unless they are from the doll department.
That I found it odd that they specifically mentioned that the doll department is peaceful, the peaceful inhabitants of the doll department. So apparently every other department in this toy mart, in this toy store, is just raging all the time.
I think it's one of those clown department things you just don't read too much into. I think you just got to roll with it.
I just, one of my favorite things to do in stuff like this, you know, the story really isn't meant to be taken seriously, but I always love looking at the story and taking it seriously just to be like, if you extrapolate this, what does this really mean in like some actual context? Find it so amusing.
Yeah, it has the funny fortune of having come out at the same year as something that did take its premise extremely seriously and kind of the rules and limits of it. So this is more like, like, I don't know, Ikari Warriors in a toy store is a little closer to kind of what we're going for at this one.
Definitely. I also read somewhere on, like, I think it was on Wikipedia, but I don't remember. Someone classified the story of this as Power Pete is the most popular toy in this toy store, and the reason why all the toys try to attack him is because they're jealous of him, which made a lot more sense than what was written in the manual, but I don't know where they got that from or if the manual changed.
Yeah, I don't have a basis for that. Power Pete's the only one with a gun. I think if a toy ran into your department like holding an actual shotgun, I think that you would attack him. Like, sure.
I mean, to be fair, it's a suction cup gun, but still, it's a gun. In toy world, that might as well be a shotgun.
I forget what they call it officially, but he has a triple barrel. Okay, sorry, it's a gumball blaster. Excuse me. But he has a triple barreled gumball blaster. It's a shotgun. Like,
yep. Speaking of weapons, we'll talk about weapons because we'll talk about the gameplay here and then we'll go into some of the levels. What I love about Power Pete, what really made this game stick out to me, was this was one of the first games that I played where you were given more than just two or three weapons, or two or three, I mean, for lack of a better term, power-ups. That's essentially what your weapons are in this, because you unlock them once you find ammo for them. So it might as well be a power-up that you have limited use until you get more ammo, because they are all weapons or guns. And there are so many in this game. There's a total of 14, and some of them are just wild. Like, you have the first weapon you get is the suction cup gun. That's your base weapon. I believe it's infinite ammo on that too. I don't think you ever will run out of ammo, but it's also the weakest weapon in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You also get a rock, a musket, a flamethrower. I love how in the manual, though, they put Summer Fun trademarked Backyard Flamethrower is the official title of the flamethrower.
Gotta have always elaborate weapon names. I'm a fan of the fact that because there's also, you get weapons themed to each level you go to, and in the candy level, which we'll get into the weirdness of the candy level, you get a tube of toothpaste as your weapon, just squirting toothpaste on your sugar enemies, which, like, I think that's honestly what stood out to me the most going back to the game, is that it's having a lot of fun with its premise. Like, this is it's a colorful game. Like, even your weapons, like the suction cup gun, like, it's not just like, you know, like a like black gun or whatever. It's like, it's like multicolored, like Nerf colors, big pink things glued to the side of it. It is a bright, colorful, animated game with big characters that make wacky cartoon sound effects. Like, they have fun with the idea of an action game that takes place in a toy store. Like, they are, I don't want to say they're like a kid in a toy store, because that just seems like tautological, but like, they are having fun with the arsenal of what's available. Like, just being able to throw in different settings and characters and weird items and all that.
Yeah, and I mean, you can actually see that fun, not to bring it back to the manual, but you can see that fun in how they write the weapon descriptions and how they kind of characterize everything in this. So, for example, the toothpaste gun, clean up your enemies, pun intended, short range, fairly powerful, but doesn't work on everything. And, you know, it's not just like they don't go into it just writing off a list of like, oh, it's, you know, power level 5 and, you know, range of 12 or something like that. They have this fun description of it, like the summer fun, the trademarked summer fun backyard flamethrower. It reads fire real red hots. Like, red hots is like a noun in this instance. Whoops, what's that still doing on our shelves? This toy was supposed to have been recalled, this doesn't make any sense, but in a few boxes were, that's what it was supposed to be, but a few boxes were overlooked in the mess following this year's Christmas rush. Too dangerous for the kids, but perfect for your purposes.
And also, just like, they have fun with what the weapons do, and even in just like the function they have in the game itself. Like you mentioned earlier, like the toothpaste gun doesn't work on everything. Like, different weapons work better on different things. Like, there are, like, one of the weapons you get earlier on is a musket gun. Like, just, I don't know why it's a musket in the toy store, but okay.
Yeah.
But like, the first level you're in is the prehistoric toy aisle, and there's big dinosaurs and things bouncing around, and like, your weaker weapons don't work on them. You have to use the musket to like hunt the big game. So there's this kind of funny, like, matching what weapon you're using to the scenario you're in. Like, they have a lot of fun with the premise, a lot more than I would expect out of something just being like an action run and gun game.
Even with the enemy variety within those levels too, like we've kind of danced around the levels a little bit, but in my opinion, it makes an argument that it's a well-designed game where the levels flow into the game design in an interesting way, where the new weapons that you get match the theme of each world that you end up going to. And there's a total of 5 worlds, with 3 levels per world. And the first one, the one we've been talking about right now, is Prehistoric Plaza. And that's filled with dinosaurs and cavemen and turtles, these prehistoric turtles later on that are peaceful, but you can kill them and get a ton of jawbreakers, which jawbreakers, think of them like Mario coins almost, where if you collect enough of them, you get more lives. But in this first section, you start out with a suction cup gun, you get a rocket. You get a musket, you get a flamethrower, you get the double barreled gumball blaster. And eventually you do get a triple barrel one, but I don't believe that's in the first section. It might be, but
it's in there. You just got to find it. It's hidden somewhere. But even like, even beyond like the, you know, the enemies and the theming, like, they have a lot of fun with the elements in the, like, the world you're in, even if it's not, they're not unique. So some of it is like in the prehistoric area, there are tar pits, and if you step in the tar pits, you die. But also, like, the areas around the tar pits are just kind of mucky, so you walk through them more slowly. But then they also just do things like, you know, it is prehistoric, so there's jungle trees, so enemies will dash out of the trees and you can't really see them, so you have to kind of navigate through the jungle carefully. But even just things like, you know, every level, the main kind of hook is you have to find a key to open a door. And they try to theme the keys really neatly. So in the prehistoric world, it's like you get like a crudely fashioned prehistoric weapon is your key, and you like smash down a wall to break through. It's like, even the common gameplay elements, they have fun re-theming for whatever world you're in. Like, they clearly were having fun with the setting they were working with.
And farther down, and one, not to jump too far ahead, but like in the funhouse level, that your tickets, or I just gave it away, your keys are tickets, because you're at a circus, you're at a carnival. So what do you get at carnivals? Tickets to go on rides. So in order to get through the giant creepy clown doors, but to get through the doors, you have to give a ticket in order to gain entrance, to gain admittance to it. Kind of a cool idea to fit the theming, like what you, like you were saying.
Yeah, and I think it's a real credit to the designers of this. I think with a lot of shareware titles back in the day where like you would have a demo and then, you know, get the rest of the game by paying X amount of money, I think there was a tendency. I don't think this was shareware specifically. I think this was, they were distributed a demo of the game. But I think there was a tendency to front load the games a little bit with the good content. Not to get into a debate about like what the best episode of Doom is, for instance, but thinking about like DOS games I enjoy that were shareware. Where, you know, the first shareware episode would have all these elaborate cutscenes and features, and then the second and third ones would just be like, here's some levels. But they didn't half-ass any of this. Like, every single world in this has a unique theme and hook to it, and unique enemies that behave differently. Like, they went all out on making sure that every world in this offered something different.
100%. And they even went down to, like, it's one of those things where if you're only playing the game without seeing the manual, you're only getting really half the experience, because they put a lot of attention into even just naming these enemies. So, for example, the cavemen, they're not just cavemen. They're Nongo the Neanderthal. When ticked off, these toys will throw bones at you. It's only fair, after all, you're shooting at them. Not to worry, though, they're made out of cheap plastic, so breaking them doesn't take much. Just one shot should do the trick, if you can hit them. They're smarter than they look. And Dino Eggs, Radical Rex. Like, I'm not going to read every single thing, but hold on. Hold the damn phone. Triceratops Tom. That's the best name I've ever heard.
That's a pretty good name for a Triceratops. But yeah, they're making them action figures. I don't know. I think, you know, a lot of games, they would, you know, write the manuals afterwards. So who knows if that was just them having fun afterwards, or if they like had mapped out like, we got all these action figures, we got to make up these fake product. Like, I don't know how they designed it, but either way, they were having fun with it, which I mean, it's all you want from something like this, right? If you have a fun premise, make it colorful and have fun with the characters and have fun with the sound, which we haven't even talked about. That's another interesting aspect of it that you mentioned in the notes, and I want to make sure we talk about, is that there's a lot of audio in this. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but there's a lot of like voiceovers for characters. Like the cavemen go unga bunga, and a little speech balloon pops out above them, and Power P has a bunch of catchphrases. He goes around and, you know, he sees a bunny and shouts, "Don't worry, I'll save you." And there's a lot of that. And it repeats a lot, but it's charming. It's I hate using that word because it means almost nothing anymore in terms of game criticism. But it's, again, they were having fun with the premise and with the world they had created. Like, even if the rules of the world don't make a lot of sense, they're rolling with it.
And the rules of the world don't need to make sense because it's in a toy store that doesn't exist anyway. So they rules be damned. It just makes some fun world. Now, the point I wanted to make about the sound, I don't know what my opinion is of it. I know I wrote in the notes just literally like two or three words. I just said music and sounds get old fast. That's all I wrote. But the thing I struggle with in my own, like trying to form an opinion and trying to seriously think about it, is I don't know if I like the music because it's nostalgic or if it's actually good. Because I think the individual tracks are fine. I feel like I like them more because of my nostalgia for it. But there's no variety in within them. Like, there's one song pretty much for each of the five worlds, and it just repeats over and over and over again.
Well, to give some additional thoughts on this, I think it varies a lot per song. It's in the style of, like, you know, an older video game where it's a 15-second music loop, right? And some of the ones, like the prehistoric world music, I think holds up a lot better because it's a little more intricate. There's kind of fun drum patterns to it and some interesting melody lines, even though it's very repetitive. By comparison, the Candy World level 2, the music is just this like oompa of like doop, 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 like over and over. And it just drills into your brain, and so it varies a lot per level, I would say. But I think
I would agree with that.
But I think, like any older game music, the ones where they, you know, did some more intricate patterns so you don't notice it looping as much, I think are more enjoyable versus the ones where it's clearly just like 10 seconds of noodling around looped over and over again.
And that's I think you're 100% right, because they're I guess to list them all off now so we can kind of talk about them as they come up throughout our conversation. The five worlds are Prehistoric Plaza, Candy Cane Lane, Fairy Tale Trail, Magic Funhouse, and the Bargain Bin, or just Bargain Bin. And Prehistoric Plaza, I'm with you. The music for Prehistoric Plaza is really good, especially the percussion in it. Candy Cane Lane's kind of eh. Fairy Tale Trail, I think, is the worst of all of them. Not only because the music is meh, but in your replay of it, did you get up to Fairy Tale Trail?
I got into it, but kind of stopped midway through. So that one didn't have a chance to like looking at the sun and you get the image burned into your eyes. Like, I didn't get that far with the music on Fairy Tale Land, unfortunately.
Well, it's not even necessarily just the music. It's the sound in general. So you mentioned before, you know, the cavemen in the first world in Prehistoric Plaza go unga bunga or something like that. And Power Pete will always say, you know, like, don't worry, I'll save you or something. There's always
take
some
that, you fiend.
Take that, you fiend. In Fairy Tale Trail, you will they do a great job at theming the enemies for each of these worlds. It's all fairy tale based. And in fact, so much so that in the manual, when it lists all the enemies for each world, in Prehistoric Plaza, they just call them the bad toys. Candy Cane Lane, they call them toys gone rotten, kind of a play off the whole, you know, sugar and teeth thing, I guess. Fairy Tale Trail, they're called Grim with two M's, Grim Adversaries. Makes sense with the whole
fairy tale. Yeah.
Well, my least favorite aspect of this entire thing is Little Miss Muffet. Little Miss Muffet, who sits on her tuffet eating her curds and whey, has spiders under her. You know, she sits on a spider the whole nursery rhyme thing.
Yeah, well, I knew it at one point very well, but.
Oh my God. So what she is, she doesn't move. She's stationary. She's sitting on her tuffet in the middle of everywhere. There's like 60 Miss Muffets throughout this freaking place. And if you get close to her, she stands up and this ear piercing nails on a chalkboard scream comes out of your speakers and spiders start chasing you. And doesn't matter if you're expecting it, because if you don't, sometimes you don't even see her on screen yet and you just hear this blood curdling scream and you just poop your pants. God. It's awful.
I did not get that far into that world. I was not aware of that. I'm going to listen to that sound effect right now.
Oh God.
If I can load it up in VLC. You know what? It's not playing in VLC right now, so I think maybe I'm spared, but man, that sounds really unpleasant. That's a really weird sound design choice.
It is not pleasant in the slightest. I overall actually like the visual aesthetic of Fairy Tale Trail.
Oh God, sorry, I just got it to play. Oh, that's hard. That's horrible. Oh my God.
It scares me shitless every time, man. Every single time I play it.
Why would they do that?
And they're everywhere. They're everywhere. And if you stay on screen, say you take out all the spiders, they will sit back down after a little while. And then they'll just get up again and do it all over again. Maybe no spiders will come out, but they'll still scream again. So it's this perpetual scream.
No, not a fan of that. Man, no, I was fine with some of the repetitive noises earlier because it's just, you know, it's a couple monsters that make a little like ha-ha-ha noise or something. But that's a kind of crossing a line. Oh, my God.
It's one of the worst moments of the game, in my opinion. And it's that sound effect has been etched into my brain, into my ears for the rest of my life. It's awful. But to get back to what you were saying before about all the different things they added to all these different levels, each one has its own unique theme, like we said, with all the different things. One thing I love about them, though, is it feels like there's something, I don't know how to put my finger on it, but it's like, Each world feels so unique, and not just because of the visuals. I also feel like in the way that the levels are designed itself, like the level layout feels very unique to each one. So Candy Cane Lane, it's basically a maze of gumdrops and like gingerbread and stuff like that. And it's a lot of having to dodge a lot of little candy bits. So you can't move quickly through that world because there is so many obstacles. Fairy Tale Trail, you are exploring castles. Magic Funhouse is they take the fun out of it. It's one of the I actually don't hate the individual levels. And in my replay of it, this is where I got to the third level of this before our recording session. Like I said, there's three levels in each world. The second level of the Magic Funhouse, there's these air vents that you can ride on. And it's the second level is just a giant maze. And it's one of those mazes, like, remember in like Pokemon Red and Blue, where you would stand on one of those things and it would propel you have no control, really. This is a little bit, it's very much like that, but you actually can control how Power Pete moves. So, for example, say the air vents are shooting you straight down. You can't go back up, but you can, as you're going down, if you see a path off to the left or to the right, you can guide Power Pete to those paths, either left, right, or down. But it's still a maze. So since you're constantly moving, you have to essentially do the same thing over and over and over again until you memorize the layout of the maze. And it's tricky because there's five bunnies there, and some of them, there's some nasty ones. I remember as a kid, this took me forever.
Yeah, I remember there's a level like that in Candy Cane Lane. That's the name of the world, right? Candy Cane, yeah, mm-hmm. Candy Cane Lane. They do a good job, I think, kind of figuring out what type of content they're going to put in what level. The prehistoric world, I think, was interesting because when I first started playing it, the comparison in my mind was like, oh, this is almost kind of maybe Gauntlet-esque in the way that it's like these, mm-hmm. it's maze-like, but not like a traditional maze. It's like rooms that are connected to each other. You're kind of moving around semi non-linearly to get through. I think it was well done like that. And then, yeah, going to the Candy Cane stage, it's a little more maze-like. There are actually some maze sections. There is a like conveyor belt-esque area, but it's because you're caught in a river of what I think was chocolate or milk chocolate or something like that. Something like chocolate milk, yeah. I think they did a good job kind of changing what type of levels you're encountering based on the world you're in, which I think, again, shows the care they put into this. The vent thing sounds frustrating, but I feel like that's kind of an inherent thing when you make like a magic or funhouse based stage, is there's just inherently going to be some bullshit like that because you're trying to like spring tricks on people, and that's what that gets interpreted as when you're doing the levels. But I appreciate their willingness to mix it up. I appreciate they didn't just do the same type of level over and over across the entire game. They tried to make something that matched the stages. I'd never got as far as the bargain bin. I don't know what is in that level, but it sounds like it's chaotic because it's the bargain bin. So I don't know if that looks like. I don't know if they try to design the levels around that theme in a meaningful way.
It's very like checkered, quite literally. Like you see like checker patterns a lot in the background. There are little toy car racetracks, so if you're standing on the racetrack, you will get hit as the car does its loop, so you have to be careful not to be on there when the cars are driving by. There are these weird, like, I think they're meant to be slinkies because they move in an arc like a slinky does, but instead of going downstairs, mm-hmm. it just stays on the same level. I'm trying to actually see what do they say everything is in the bargain bin. They don't even tell you. In every level or every world in the manual, it gives you a very detailed layout of all the different enemies you face. But the bargain bin, it just says, let the buyer beware. That's right. On special today only, survive four levels, get one free. The catch is no toy ever banished to these sales racks has ever returned. And well, I didn't exactly make it all the way through those Blasted Clowns territory myself. In other words, there's no clues I can give you. The last few missing fuzzy bunnies are lost somewhere in this chaotic red tag, blue light nightmare, and you're completely on your own. It was nice knowing you, kid.
I mean, actually, I'm looking at a screenshot now, and yeah, the levels seem very chaotically open-ended. I see a what appears to be like a hockey trading card used as like a prop at one point. Like, that's kind of fun that it's just like, all right, here's the mishmash of random toy stuff in a chaos level with no particularly strong theming. It's like, you know what? That's kind of fun if you're going to do a level like that. Like, I appreciate that they resisted the urge to do that for the entire game. That they just had, that's kind of the final area. That's neat. I think that shows, if not good design, then at least, I don't know, intentional design on their part to like make sure they're like designing around a theme. That's, I think that's a good sign.
I agree. And throughout all five of these levels, we've touched on the weapons before, and I'm not going to list all of them. Like I said, there's pie, or I can list at least a few of them. Pies, rubber band shooters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do like the manual's description for pies. It says, finally, your chance to splatter the clowns on your own terms. The flavor text for this is honestly pretty good.
Oh, yeah. I was a fan of the fact that one of the items is just exploding birthday cake. Which
That's the best weapon in the game.
Yeah, it's got a huge radius. It's great. Yeah.
AoE does the most amount of damage. They give you them so frequently. One of the cool things that this game does, we didn't get to touch on it yet, but it deals with the weapons. There's a lot of secrets in these worlds where, like, you can find hidden areas, and usually in the last level of a world, if you find the hidden area, you find a specific hidden area, it usually gives you the weapons that you're going to get for the next world over. So the last level of Prehistoric Plaza, if you find the hidden area, you can actually get cakes a level early. You can get, I want to say, toothpaste a level early as well. You can get all that. Yeah, that's how I found out. It's really cool. And that's when I discovered the beauty of cake. It ruins everything in this game. But besides these specific weapons, one of the things that I think makes Power Pete unique compared to other kind of top-down run-and-gun shooters is that you get, I don't want to technically call them power-ups. They're like a combination of a power-up and a weapon, where when you kill enemies, these items will drop on the ground. And there's usually just these little gray icons with a color, different color center. And depending on what color center it is, determines some type of power up or like bonus attack or weapon or a bonus perk that's usually temporary that will assist you. So, for example, if there's a blue icon in the center, that means every enemy on the screen freezes for 30 seconds or like 10 seconds or something like that. So you can kill them and collect the jawbreakers from them, or you can just run right by them. If it's red, it unleashes a bolt of fire, and it has all these flame wheels that go around. If it's gray, it essentially is like artillery. He yells fire in the hole and shit starts blowing up everywhere. If it's yellow, you get super fast. If it's green, you get a shield. And there's all these really cool little, they're not quite power-ups because they're not permanent, but when you're playing the game and you're surrounded by a bunch of enemies, there's nothing more satisfying than you're able to take one out and it's got one of those red drops. So you hit it and the fire wheel expands out and it goes in all directions and steadily pans out. And all the enemies that are on top of you are pretty much gone from that one attack. It's one of the most like viscerally satisfying experiences I've had in gaming. What are your thoughts on these kind of like power drops though?
It's nice. It reminded me of something, just for some reason, the two things that came to, actually the one that came to mind immediately was like Arkanoid, where it's like you just get random drops from the blocks you break and it's, you just kind of roll with it. It's like, all right, we got freeze. What am I going to do with this the next couple seconds? All right, I've got speed. What should I reasonably do? Maybe I shouldn't go extremely fast into the next area. Yeah, it's a nice touch. It's nice that it just kind of gives you these little things to pick up. The weapons are a little more predictable. You kind of get those at a regular interval where, like, this level you're going to get more of the musket. This level you're getting more of the rocks. Again, that changes per world, too. But yeah, I like it. I like having just kind of this little randomized element of, like, hey, you're going to get a little thing. You got to take advantage of it while you can. Just a nice little touch. I will say on the, I mentioned trying to play this on the original Macintosh version emulated earlier. Man, some of those things are inconsistent there, especially if you're having performance issues. The speed power up, if you are running that game at full speed, is very unwieldy. And that was the first sign to me where it was like, this isn't right. This shouldn't be going as fast as it is.
It's the speed power up, I think, is actually one of the worst ones to get because it's so hard to control. Even with the nice port that Joryo did to modern computers, it is still very finicky. It is very hard to control. And then you, on top of that, that Magic Funhouse level I was telling you about with like the air grates or whatever. If you can outrun the camera sometimes, or you can actually run against the air grates because you move so fast with the speed power up. Granted, it's still only a temporary amount of time, like a small amount of time. So you can't like just completely, you're not free to explore all those air grates that force you along, but if you're strategic with it, or if you, I shouldn't say strategic, if you get lucky with a drop, you might be able to utilize it, depending on where it's dropped and whatnot, you might be able to utilize it to break the intended route that the developers wanted you to go on. But I can't imagine that happening. Like, that's praying to the RNG gods, to RNG Jesus, and hoping that it works out.
I think it's also a game that, and this is a good, I think, distinction between the older and newer versions of it. The original version of Power Pete has a much smaller viewing window. It's kind of this smaller, boxier window. So if you get the speed power up, oftentimes you run into a room very fast and can't tell that there's going to be, like, you know, 10 dinosaurs immediately bearing down on you as soon as you walk in. So it's just kind of a death trap as soon as you enter. One of the nice things they added to the modern ports is that obviously it's taking advantage of widescreen resolution and just the fact that they can get more on the screen. So the play window is larger and you can actually see what's coming. And I found that that changed how I played the game. I think on the Macintosh version, it paid to be a little more cautious and kind of inch your way into rooms. And you really didn't want the speed power up. But I think, and it's an interesting point of comparison to see the original version of the game versus sort of the enhanced version. And I don't know, it adds a lot to it. I think another point in favor of just going right to the modern versions, if you are curious about this game, just something as simple as making the window a little bit bigger, just, I think, hugely increases the playability of it.
I never even thought about that, but you're right. Because, you know, you talk about how when game developers design games, they design it for specific experiences. You know, a lot of times people talk about, you know, like the 5-foot experience versus the 1-foot experience, you know, handheld and PC versus like home console type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I never would have really thought about this type of experience about the, it's not really a, you know, 1-foot versus 5-foot experience, but a resolution experience, you know, how much that can actually change the mechanics of the game, not necessarily intentionally either. Because I even think back to like Mario and the handhelds where the screen was so much smaller, especially like, you know, Mario Land 2, where they had to completely change the design around for it to accommodate for the less screen real estate. But I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about Macintosh games in general. So, I mean, the Macintosh, stepping back for a second, like a lot of computer games at this point, DOS action games, let's say, the resolution was usually like 320 by 200, maybe 320 by 240. So it was even blown up on the screen. You weren't getting the full resolution. It was a little pixely. Macintosh could do like full 640 by 480 pretty well. So you had a combination of things. You had some developers would keep smaller sprites and just take advantage of the fact that they could fit bigger levels on screen. Or some developers would do bigger sprites, which resulted in this still kind of limited screen space. And that's what Power Pete does. You know, you have a big, chunky main character whose chin is like, I don't know, as big as like Mario's head on Super Mario Brothers NES. So that takes up more space. So I think it's interesting that it kind of comes around that, you know, 30 years later on the modern PC version, they are once again able to take advantage of, oh, we have more resolution. We can just get more of these bigger sprites on screen instead of trying to blow them up even further. I think a more literal adaptation, I don't know, I could imagine like someone making a misguided Power Pete HD where the sprites all have the same relative screen size, as opposed to like, no, like what didn't work about the game before is the fact that it had this very small viewing window. And let's take advantage of that and let the player see more in all directions. Mm-hmm. And I think that just, I don't know. It's interesting that the Mac was kind of at an inflection point where it was like, all right, do you make the sprites bigger? Do you take advantage of the additional pixels? And that ended up mattering much, much later on.
Yeah, I never really would have thought about that. That's really interesting. Now, Phil, we are starting to get low on time. So what I do want to ask you before we wrap up, we still have a little bit more to talk about. I figured we should list what our favorites were in this game. And I already mentioned before my favorite weapon was the cake. What do they describe it as? Exploding cakes.
Yeah.
But I want to know about you. What was your favorite weapon in the game? And then we'll go on and talk about our favorite levels.
I mean, likewise, the exploding cake of the toothpaste, only because they were clearly getting weird with it. I think the other ones, you know, they have analogs, like the gumball blasters are clearly shotguns. The flamethrower is a flamethrower. The suction cup gun is a gun, versus a toothpaste. Maybe the closest is like a short range laser that only works against enemies made out of sugar. Like I like when they got weird and specific in a way that kind of played with the toy dimension of the game.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that. Besides the exploding cake, I also like the fairy dust. Like you were saying, there's specific things that are applicable to individual levels, and the fairy dust is specific for Fairy Tale Trail. And like the toothpaste was good for Candy Cane Lane, fairy dust was good for Fairy Tale Trail, and it really kind of worked. It really kind of took out the enemies easily there. That was also my second favorite weapon in the game. But besides weapons, some of them come from specific worlds. What is your favorite world that you did play on? Or you never got to Bargain Bin, but based off what you did see of it, maybe that takes the crown for you. But yeah, in your opinion, from what you've played, what were some of your favorite worlds or your favorite world?
I mean, of the ones I played, I mean, I think the prehistoric one was the most well-rounded in terms of just having interesting level design and getting all the features out at once. I felt like it was well-rounded. I'm going to say that word again, but it was very well-rounded. But the candy stage that came afterwards, I think I liked that one because it stuck the landing for me. Again, I think there's a hesitation where I think a lot of games will front load a lot of their interesting content. And I could imagine by the end, it's like, oh, shit, it's level 4. What do we do? I don't know, put some conveyor belts in it or something like that. But Candy Cane Lane was different and distinct enough that it stood out to me as like these developers have different ideas in mind they want to execute in this game. So I'm going to say Candy Cane Lane only because I think that showed that it, you know, the first time I played this game as a kid, I only had the demo. I only had the first couple levels. I don't think I even finished all of the prehistoric levels. So seeing Candy Cane Lane for the first time, it was like, yeah, this isn't a one-trick pony. There is more to this game. So I give it points for that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. For myself, I think I'd have to get, actually, despite how much I railed against it, I actually like Magic Funhouse.
Okay. I thought you were going to say the fairy tale stage.
No.
All the screaming noises, which no, you should edit this podcast and just insert one of those screams randomly in the middle of this episode.
Just to scare my listeners.
Give them the Power Pete experience. Yeah, exactly.
I can't, that scream, dude, I can't get over it. It's just nuts. Magic Funhouse, as much as I hate the second level, I like the aesthetic of everything else with the clowns. And apparently we're fighting our way through a clown department.
Clown department right there. Yeah.
Who works in the clown department? Is it a bunch of clowns? Like, do they hire clowns, like real people clowns to work in the clown department?
I think I'm trying to picture just like, I don't know, the people. What was I gonna say? I feel like you often see people who are like, "Oh, I'd love to see like more like short stories exploring like, you know, the Marvel world through the eyes of someone who's not a superhero or something like that." I want to see the story of the person who's hired to work at this toy store, who's like, yeah, assigned to the clown department and is forced to be in clown mode all day, and that just doesn't sound. No one should have that job.
Fanfic writers, get on it. We need to see Power Pete fan fiction. I want it sent to, actually, you know what, maybe I don't want it sent to my DMs.
I guarantee the AO3 category for Power Pete does not exist. I'm gonna look this up as we're wrapping this episode up. That's where the good stuff is these days. Yeah,
I hope there is a Power Pete. Oh my gosh, I hope there's Power Pete fan fiction on Archive Ever, and that'd be so funny. While you're looking that up, we'll start wrapping up this episode. Last thing I want to say before we go into our plugs and our personal shout outs and all that good stuff is there. I found this really amusing. Once again, I'm shouting out this manual a lot. I found it really humorous how they wrote it, how it wasn't just some straight up, you know, like serious document. They had fun with it, just like they did with the game and how we kind of described it. The technical support section for this manual, if your game isn't working and you need help from Pangea Soft, this is what they say. Mighty Mike was first released in 1995, and to be totally honest, those of us who built this game don't really remember much in terms of where to find all the bunnies and how to get out of all the levels. It's sad but true. So we highly recommend that you check out our website at pangeasoft.net/mightymike. They will have information and links to other sites with helpful information on the game. If, however, you have a question of technical nature and not related to gameplay, then please feel free to send your question to, and they provide an email address, which Pangea Soft, I guess, as a little button for this episode before our plugs, sadly no longer exists. But that's not that recent. They actually went on to become iOS developers for a number of years. They published a bunch of games on iPhone. And I want to say PangeaSoft only closed somewhat recently, at least from what I can see. Like Brian Greenstone, I don't even believe is even working. I don't know if he's even on his like LinkedIn, if he even includes it anymore. I'm going to have to double check it.
I assume Pangea Software as a functional entity was like one or two people at a certain, like at a certain point when you're a developer of that scale, you can kind of exist as long as you're interested in doing it. And like, I was recently researching an older Macintosh game developer, the name of which is escaping me right now. Delta Tau was the name of the developer, and their website is still up and they technically have a store. If you try to buy anything, the store doesn't work. If you email them, the guy will be like, yeah, sorry, store doesn't work. I don't know. But it's like the company exists in the sense that it's just the one guy who owns the rights to the game and still has the storefront up.
That's, I mean, it's wild that stuff like that can even still happen. Like the things are up, but then no one knows how to work it. That's just odd to me.
You could end up in a bad scenario where you have something like one of the other big Macintosh shareware developers in the era was Ambrosia Software, did a lot of fascinating, interesting, colorful, wacky, psychedelic arcade game stuff for Mac. And they, for a while, you know, they sold all their old games through their website. But for a while, the store was functional. You could, if I remember right, I heard that you could like still order things, but you wouldn't receive them. So it just got to a point where it was like this like dead store walking where it's like, well, technically you can buy the games, but eventually like the site's just gone now. I think I don't know how to get in touch with anyone there. So I think, you know, maybe better to end on your own terms than just like let this get dragged out until it's, you know, some website that somebody is paying for after you die. So good for them for ending on their own terms, I guess.
I mean, to be clear, this is still somewhat speculation because I remember reading it somewhere, but I can't find it. So then the website is still up, but the copyright on the website is only updated to 2015. So it's like this weird hybrid of like the it everywhere that I can read, it still seems like they're still in business, but at the same time, they haven't really done anything on their website for the last 8 years, for almost a decade. So I don't really know.
If it's just one guy, you know, the company only exists as long as they care, I guess.
I'll look it up a little bit more, but I found Brian Greenstone's website. I'll look into it a little bit more. But in any case, let's wrap up this episode. Phil, thank you so much for joining me for this discussion on PowerPete. I know we had a little bit of a time limit due to some unfortunate circumstances, but I'm very grateful for the time you were willing to give me here. And
Everyone go get vaccinated this season. That is the reason why we have kind of a time limit on this episode right now. Little under the weather as I'm recording it. So,
and Phil's being a goddamn trooper, still recording an over hour long episode while getting over the flu or something like that. So
for seriously, Powered man, Pete, absolutely. My God.
You powered through for Powered Pete.
I mightied through for Mightied Mike.
I'm going to use that now and everyone's going to give me weird looks and I'm kind of here for it.
Yeah, it's a guy, I mighty through. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? That's not a word.
I really want that to be. I think we can make that a thing.
Starts here.
But so I actually first discovered you through, you mentioned it before, the Obscuratory. Specifically back in 2020 when you were able to find a working version of Sim Refinery, and seemed to blow up for you, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you know, I had been plugging away at the Obscuratory for many years, and I had an audience, which I was happy with. But once the Sim Refinery stuff, and that was, for the record, that was the serious game developed by the people who made Sim City, Maxis Software. They made it for the Chevron Corporation. Things really blew up at that point, and so things have been on kind of an upward trajectory since then. Still hoping to get back to doing Obscuratory stuff. I've just had a lot on my plate recently. I'm actually working on a book about Maxis Software, which, I have to actually write that thing. But
when you are ready to start publishing, let me know. I will have you back on to help promote it.
Well, check back in some point in the future. I'm not going to make any promises. but otherwise, right now, I'm trying to get back to streaming through the Obscuratory. So I'm frequently doing that at twitch.tv/Obscuratory. But most of my energy right now is going to my work at the Video Game History Foundation. Really encourage folks to follow us on Patreon at patreon.com/gamehistory.org. We always appreciate people's support as we're exploring all these kind of interesting corners of how we're going to make video game history better. We've got some big things on our plate for the next couple of years. You know, we have this digital library we're working on that we're building up. We're going to have all sorts of cool behind the scenes resources from video games to share. Got some cool mech game stuff I haven't told anyone about yet because we haven't announced it. That's really cool. We've got, we are helping fight to change the law to make it easier for libraries and archives to provide access to their video game collections. We're working with folks from the Software Preservation Network to try to actually literally change the law on this stuff. So we've got a lot of cool things we're doing. So if you want to stay tuned on what's going on with that, yeah, check out what the Video Game History Foundation is doing. Always appreciate folks' support.
Yes, I listened to your appearance on Retronauts talking about you and it was you and Kelsey, I want to say, on that.
Yeah, Kelsey Lou, yeah, we were on that one.
Just talking all about the study that you guys did about how how many games are lost. You know, that study was
87% are out of print. And that was actually the Delta Tau one was why we were doing that for the study. One of the games in our random sample was this old Macintosh shareware game. And I had to email the guy and say, are you selling this? He was like, well, not really, no. So I was like, all right, that game is out of print, effectively. So
yeah,
it's a mess, but we are trying the best we can to help fix the future.
And you guys are doing fantastic work. And I'm really grateful to have you on for this and talk about PowerPoint, but also promote the Game History Foundation. It's something I'm super passionate about as well. I actually did a whole episode on game history myself, but it was pretty much just parroting a lot of the stuff that Frank and Kelsey put up on the website about just, it was more or less to bring awareness to my audience than actually for me to come up with something original on my own. It was more or less just, like I said, I want more people to care about game history, and I try to share it in any way that I can.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And it's funny, over the last couple of months, the study we did obviously got a lot of traction. So I've been doing a lot of interviews and podcasts about, like, you know, why is game preservation important? So I was almost burnt out on doing that. So seeing an invitation to talk about PowerPete, it was like, oh, hell yeah, let's take this hard left turn into doing something totally different.
Something that I guarantee you is not going to get me a lot of listens because no one cares about very few people know about this. But I love covering like stuff like this. I don't care if people don't really know about it. To me, it's worth talking about.
There's a wonderful quote from a friend and colleague, Rachel Weil, that I want to quote here. If I have it handy, probably a good note to end on, where she said that one of the greatest powers of bygone video games lies in their ability to inspire the next generation. Keeping old games in a drawer is not enough. They have to be dusted off, booted up, played, enjoyed, discussed, and remembered. So, yeah, I think that's a good note to end on.
That's what we did here. Yeah. So, and for my own shout outs, of course, and before I go into the shout outs, I did double check on Brian Greenstone's LinkedIn. He still lists Pangea Software as active. So even though nothing's been going on for it for almost a decade, he's still listing as active. He also has a company called Greenstone Fine Mineralia, where he sells mineral specimens like fluorite and barite and aquamarine and calcite. So that is a wild crossroads.
I do love seeing what a lot of the software developers from that era would go on to do. My favorite I ever saw was I contacted a shareware developer who has since gone on to become a professional psychic. It's like, oh, sure, okay.
You do you, man. You do you. That's kind of awesome.
She was very nice. Just a big, big unexpected left turn.
That's so cool, actually. But all right. For my own shenanigans, you can follow me on social media at Still Loading Pod on pretty much everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads, all that good stuff, Twitch, at Still Loading Podcast on YouTube. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use, like Podcast Addict has their own in-house reviews thing. And that makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And I like feeling warm and fuzzy. And it, if it's true that it pleases the algorithm gods, that it helps more people find the show, that would be also super. I'd be very grateful for anyone who drops a review. Preferably 5-star. If you want to support the show monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod for $1 a month. You'll get all the episodes a little bit early with better audio quality, as well as access to patron voting rights, where you can help guide future topics of the show. At the time this comes out, I believe one will have just ended, and ended about a couple weeks ago, actually, and it was going to be on a PSP game. I asked my patrons to pick between four different PSP games, and that'll be another one I'm covering. So yeah, patreon.com/stillloadingpod, that you get all that for $1 a month. For $4 a month, you get everything mentioned prior, plus two mini bonus episodes a month. And for $5 a month, you get everything I mentioned before, plus access to Still Bonding, which is my monthly James Bond podcast where me and a few friends bond over 007.
I get it.
Yeah. where at the time this is coming out, the most recent episode, I think, if I'm doing my math correctly, will have been either A View to a Kill or The Living Daylights is on its way out. So covering all that good stuff. And yeah, that's over at patreon.com/stillloadingpod. And the final thing I want to mention is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that is all the time I have for you on this episode of Still Loading. Phil, thank you once again, man, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And I will see you all next time.